Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. How are you doing? It feels so different when the sun shines. Man, it's just amazing when you just see a little bit of the possibility of spring. So I hope you have some of that where you are. Or maybe somewhere else in the world, of course, and the weather's already nice. It's been an unbelievably busy time, of course, for me with the book being out. Trying to kind of get a book out there in lockdown is not the easiest. So, anyone who wants to buy it and give me a review, I'd hugely appreciate. But I've done some really good podcasts, which has been great. It's nice to be on the other side of the mic for a change. So I've been on some nice podcasts. I'm sure you'll get to hear some of them soon if you haven't already. I'm going to be on Love Sober's podcast with Kate, which is great. Kate and Mandy's podcast. And I'm hopefully I'm going to be on Gabby Roslin's podcast soon as well. So that'll be fun. So there's a huge amount going on. We've had some wonderful stuff going on in the Sober Club. We had a Zoom session and sort of various breakout rooms and things, and it was really magical. And we kind of ended up talking in our group last week about just the importance of our thoughts and those thoughts that we drop into our unconscious mind. And of course, I talk about this a lot in the book, the fact that we can choose our thoughts. And I know it doesn't always feel like that because it feels as though our thoughts control us. But we can choose our thoughts, and we can reframe the negative stuff and challenge it and ask if it's true. And by that, I don't necessarily mean that you have to walk around being Pollyanna the whole time, because that maybe doesn't work, because, you know, there is some negative stuff in our lives, to say the least. But we can choose what we'll think about at any given time. And I just think it really helps to remind ourselves of that, particularly if you're feeling, super anxious. I mean, I know that in the UK, we've had this, you know, Boris has given us a roadmap, let's see what happens. But I know some people are actually a little bit nervous of coming out of lockdown, because they've been in a bubble. And I use that word, you know, in its traditional sense, not in the six people sense. They've been in that kind of bubble almost. And if this has been the time that you've ditched the booze, then actually coming out of that can feel a little bit scary. Change is always feels tough, doesn't it? So I'm definitely going to do a bit more about that. We'll do a session around really gathering your confidence and standing powerfully in your sober shoes before you venture out into the big wide world. On today's podcast, I'm going to tell you a bit about Mockingbird. I think I've mentioned this brand, such a unique brand. I said that for a few weeks while the book is out, and I'm trying to encourage people to keep the ritual, change the ingredients. You know, this is my thing, and I really do believe it's the game changer for people who just cannot comprehend not having a drink at the end of the day. And that's fine. What's wrong with that? Drinking is what we do. Look, just let's not make it alcohol, right? So I'm teaming up with a few brands, and Mockingbird. I want to tell you about this brand because they're the UK's first non-alcoholic tequila alternative. So really totally unique. And then my main guest this week, you might think this is completely off topic, and why is she doing that? But I'm interviewing Sharon Paul, who is, we'll explain what she is, but basically our topic is grief and also looking at our own end of life journey and how we can prepare our relatives for that. So you might think, well, what's that got to do with any of it? But this came about because several Sober Club members actually said to me, look, I've started drinking since I lost a family member, or sometimes people start drinking because of unresolved trauma from someone they lost many years ago. So to me, there's no doubt that grief and alcohol or destructive behaviours are very linked. And I also think, why wouldn't any of us, if we had an opportunity, put some thought into how we can focus on our own end of life journey and make it, you know, as easy as we can for those around us. So I know it's not strictly, you know, here's how we ditch the booze and get healthy. But, you know, I am trying to look at the whole holistic picture. And I think it's definitely part of the optimum health and well-being piece. And Sharon is, you know, so inspirational. So we'll be chatting to Sharon in a little while. But let me tell you about a bit more about Mockingbird then. So I found out some really interesting stuff about tequila. Apparently it's traditionally made by fermenting the sugars of the blue agave plant. So this is spiky kind of mineral coloured plant native to South America. And that's what gives tequila its distinctive flavour profile. So when Mockingbird decided that they wanted to create an alcohol-free option, that's where they started. So they got their blue agave right from its source in the town of Tequila in Mexico. And apparently its full name is Agave Ticalana. I wouldn't have said that right, will I? Tequilana Blue Weber. And they call it Old Blue for short. So they sourced this blue agave. And then, of course, the next challenge was to get something similar to the taste of tequila, but without any alcohol. So they spent several months dialing up the spice and finding a way of making it hot and tinkering with the smokiness until they found this, you know, they really had this drink that mimicked the taste of tequila. But then they also thought, well, how about giving it a natural boost? So they chose to add ashwagandha to the mix. Now, this is where I think it gets super interesting, because ashwagandha, and there's a whole section in my book on adaptogens, and ashwagandha is one, of course, that helps your mind and body manage stress and anxiety. So in other words, it does the exact opposite to what alcohol does. While alcohol is a depressant and makes you more anxious, ashwagandha is one of their hero ingredients in this, because it will help to boost the immunity both mentally and physically. So it's super good for you. And as they say, when booze brings you down, organic ashwagandha can lift you up and help you naturally to have, you know, more, feel more productive and have more clarity. So it's a really cool, unique drink. And then flavour wise, they added vanilla pods to sweeten it a little bit, and lemon to bring out the citrus notes, and a dash of habanero, that's how you say it, isn't it? So that it makes it a little bit spicy and a bit smoky, and then a bit of cinnamon to complete the taste palette. So this is a great drink. It's authentic quality and natural, and honestly, you're going to love it. It's really unique. So it's Mockingbird. The website is mockingbirdspirit.com. But we've got a competition to give a bottle of Mockingbird away. So make sure you check out thesoberclub.com for the competition. And also, they have got a code to get 20% off the full size bottle. So the code is soberclub20. Soberclub20 to get 20% off the full size bottles. So there you go. Mockingbird. I love it. Absolutely love it. Honestly, these alcohol-free drinks, they're just an absolute game changer. I really believe that. So changing the tone completely then from our happy alcohol-free drink, let's hear our interview on grief. We're talking grief and death and taking responsibility for your own end of life journey. And Sharon Paul has been a psychotherapist and bereavement counsellor for over 20 years. She's also trained as a holistic therapist for the dying, end of life guide with DIY funerals. We'll definitely have to talk more about that. And Sharon is deeply passionate about supporting people to die in the comfort of their own home and empowering them in creating their own farewell celebration. I love the sound of that. How amazing. Sharon, thank you so much for being my guest.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, I've been wanting to do this topic for such a long time. And then I've had, you know, Sober Club members who've said it's, you know, it feels really important. And of course, it's such a massive topic. And, you know, death is so much part of life, but we don't actually talk about it very much in this country, do we? I mean, I know you do because it's your thing. But am I right in saying that it still is kind of taboo?
Yeah, we're very, what we call in the trade, death phobic. You know, people just don't want to talk about it, and they get caught up with lots of anxiety and fear. I mean, even if I go to talk to my two grown-up daughters, it's like, no, I don't want to know, Mum. You know, the family don't want to talk about it.
Is interesting. It is, and you know, I've heard a lot of people say that quite apart from anything else, you know, it's the one thing that's definitely going to happen to us all. And that's a definite, right?
Yeah.
And yet we're not prepped for it in any way. And often when people, you know, have a bereavement in their family, they've got absolutely no idea what to do, because no one has talked you through this. No one teaches you any of this stuff. You don't learn it in school. You don't really learn it at all. And as you say, most people don't discuss it. So, you know, in addition to the what can often be a shock and a grieving process, you've got to deal with stuff that you've got no idea how to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, I always try and say to people, the most loving thing that you can do for your family is to prepare your dying and your death the best that you can. I mean, none of us know when that day is going to come. Some of us luckily are told that we've got so many years or so many months, and some people it just becomes really sudden. So the most loving thing we can do is kind of have it organized. Because what happens is, if people don't, in my experience, it causes so much more anxiety and family feuds, because one person will say, oh no, they wouldn't want that, or they would have wanted that. So it causes a lot of extra upset and grief.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely want to talk more about that. I really do think it's so important to be willing to look at your own, you know, end of life journey, as you say. But it's not something we want to do. I mean, it really isn't. I can't tell you how long I put off even making a will. You know, we all think we're immortal, don't we? It's bizarre. But one of the reasons that I really wanted to chat to you in this context is that, you know, often there is a big link between grief and people drinking more. You know, someone dies and suddenly, well, quite apart from the fact that, of course, alcohol is so intrinsically linked with celebrations and commiserations, but even aside from the actual funeral or whatever itself, even people who have perhaps stopped drinking for quite a long time might find that when they're hit by grief, it's literally such a roller coaster of emotions that just sends them back drinking again. You know, I don't know what my question is really, but I just wonder how does grief impact people in different ways? And do you have an understanding that happens for some people? Have you come across that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because people, you know, in the days we live in, we're very numbed out. You know, people tend to want to not feel, so they will reach to alcohol, drugs, even prescription drugs. You know, that's a massive thing in our society as well. And a glass of wine or two or three, you know, is the easiest way to not be able to feel. Because the pain of grief can be so intense and overwhelming that people just don't want to feel it, when actually, if you allowed yourself to feel it and go through that process, the healing is a lot quicker. So the more you numb it out, the longer it will take. I mean, you know, how do you ever heal from somebody that you really love that's close to you? I think you just learn to live with it. And grief is a way of loving. You know, and love, it can be opposite. You know, love is a way of grieving. It's a fine line, I think.
Yeah. Can you explain to us then a bit more about that? You know, that's when you say, you know, allow yourself to grieve. How can we do that in a respectful way, in a way that supports us? I mean, are there different stages of grief that most people go through?
There are different stages of grief. You know, sometimes people will feel deeply sad and then they feel really angry, and then they might have a day when they feel all right and then they feel bad about feeling okay. And, you know, then they can be really fearful. So it goes in. I mean, there is a typical grief circle, but really I think on the whole, it's just, if in every day you just allow yourself to be and feel how you want to feel. And in our society, people really want to go to people, oh, you know, you'll get over it. Or they make all these statements that, oh, you know, you're really lucky that if it was your husband, you had such a loving husband. And they say all these comments and statements that are really not helpful. And the kindest thing we can do for somebody that's grieving is just hold a space of love for them. Let them chat about that loved one as much as they want. And, you know, even if it goes, I mean, as a bereavement counsellor, if someone's coming to me 6 months down the line, I will say to them, it's far too soon.
Really?
If it goes on like years, then there's a delicate way of looking at it. But people's grief can be shorter than and longer, depending on each person and depending on the situation.
Mm. But how much should we, I know it's so different for everyone, so it's really difficult to ascertain this, but should we sort of, I don't even know what the expression is. I suppose what I'm thinking to myself is, you know, we talk about, we have a birth plan, and then when we give birth, then in theory, if you can actually properly bond with your baby and have some time, you know, they call it the golden hour straight after birth. And then in other cultures, there's about a month where in an ideal world, people would bring you meals. How amazing would that be? And so there's that sort of precious time when you first had your baby that if you allow yourself that time to actually bond with your baby before you rush back into everything, it's really magical. And I just wonder whether it's the same when there's been, when you've got, extreme grief of someone close to you. Is there anything that we can do to help that process? I mean, unfortunately, I suppose most people can't just step away from life for a month, can they?
Well, that would be ideal. That would be really ideal. And people tend to rush back to work too quick. So they get in that automatic thing of being busy. Again, it's an avoidance. I don't know whether this is a bit delicate to talk about, but tell me if it is. Recently, we did a service for a young lady that had committed suicide. And so, I can't imagine how the parents felt. It must have been awful. But, the mother more so, because men tend to, numb it out and stuff it down and don't want to talk about it. She continually wants to talk about that. And yes, she's lucky, not lucky at all, sorry, that's probably the wrong thing to say, but she can be at home and she can grieve. But what she's finding is people don't want to talk about it. And she wants to keep her daughter's memory alive by just keeping talking. And I think it's more so in the talking that then we can move through it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting, topic, because of course, there'll be people listening who have lost, elderly parents or they've lost people who have been seriously ill. And there's been an expectation, that they have an expectation that their death may not be long for whatever reason. It doesn't mean it makes it any less painful, of course. But that is quite different to when it's a sudden death, isn't it? Or when it's a death of someone very young. I have a friend who lost her son as a teenager. It just absolutely tore her apart. I mean, completely tore her apart. So, how can people deal with that, by anyone's standards, really cruel death? Because people have those feelings of, why has this happened to me? How can we even begin to deal with those kind of situations?
I don't know if there's an answer for that, to be quite honest, because if you lose a child and it is a suicide, I think as parents, and I know I would be, it's the unanswered questions. Mm. And if there's no or anything left to say why, it's what the mind wants to do is always make sense of something. Mm. And that's really difficult to let go of.
But even if it was an accident or an illness, there still is that sense of, why has this happened to me? This is so unfair. And also, I think sometimes people carry these feelings of almost guilt. Like, it should have been me. It should have been my time, not theirs. They're young.
Yeah, guilt is a massive thing that people carry. But sometimes how I look at that within myself is, that why not me? I suppose, well, why not me? Because I'm not immune from pain or, one of my children doing that or sudden death happening in my family. It's like, for me personally, I'll say, I obviously I can get into that, but why not me? Why is it better for somebody else to experience that rather than me going through that?
Yeah.
And depending, I suppose, on where people are, whether they have a spirituality, whether they have a faith, whether they don't, is how differently also that can be a comfort. and how that can help people.
Yeah. And then, No, Karen.
I do think that the greatest thing that we can do for somebody who's grieving and for ourselves is be kind, you know, really be kind to ourselves. We're always going to roll those questions in our head. I don't think that's a job of the mind, I think, and it you know, beat us up a little bit. And it's just that be kind to ourselves and just allow yourself to be who you need to be authentic in your grief and for people around you. And also talk about that. You know, at the moment, we're looking after a gentleman who's probably not got that long, and his two children, or his two grown-up daughters, are not talking to each other.
Oh, wow.
And so the mum's really struggling with it. The father's really struggling with it. And, there's this unspoken stuff. So the mum was saying to me, the thing that I would really like to happen is for my daughters to be speaking before this. I said, well, have you spoke to them about it? And she said, well, no. And I said, this is the time for you to, and especially for the gentleman, you know, you're on your deathbed, this is the time. You've got the right to say whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly. Because people aren't mind readers, are they? You know, she does need to tell them. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And this, the other, you know, we've already mentioned guilt. And then I got a question from someone saying for me to ask you how best to deal with anger. This person said people would advise me to trust in the universe and that God would only give me something I could handle. And I know that they meant well, but I would rage inside. This is someone who lost a child.
Yeah.
There were so many platitudes and the positivity felt almost toxic. And I felt I had to hide behind a mask so that society could feel comfortable. Oh my goodness. And you can feel the pain in that, can't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a thing. This rage is a thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And that makes me squirm, the fact that somebody would say that to somebody, you know, in their time of grief like that. It's not helpful. For me personally, I think it's unkind. People, and I think it's something about that person, you know, they want to fix it or they can't cope with it. And a lot of people can't cope with people that are grieving because actually they feel uncomfortable and they don't know what to say. And all that positive language is more harmful when people are in the depths of grief. There's a time and a place for stuff like that, and it's definitely not when people are in them really early stages and mid stages of grief. Sometimes this is more not to say anything, just to, you know, put a hand on somebody or comfort them.
Yeah. And as you say, you know, often, I mean, I think it's in a sense, you know, when there is a link to, you know, when people are stopping drinking, actually they need to be able to talk to other people who have been there, done it. They need people who understand and are willing to listen. There's no point in having a big old fight with someone who just wants to carry on drinking. So I think really being able to stay connected is really important, isn't it? Rather than retreating and just get, you know, taking a bottle with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And in also that, you know, there's a great loss and a grief when your identity changes from not drinking, from being, you know, drinking to not drinking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What about rituals and, you know, where do kind of rituals come in, do you think, when we're dealing with death? Do you think it's important that we have certain rituals around death? And I mean, we'll talk about the funerals part in a moment, but just around the grieving process almost, is there anything that can help the person who's grieving to cherish the memory of the person that's died?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways. I mean, people, you know, have like people's photos out, things like putting a candle by, you know, the photo, making your own little altar is always a nice little thing. And I suppose depending on what you did in life together is what you can carry on doing for a while after that person's gone. Some people still lay a breakfast place out and a dinner place. And, you know, there's a time when it will just naturally not happen. So it's all the things that you feel comfortable doing as a little ritual with what you say, it's your partner or your husband or your wife. To still do them little rituals. Some people, if they lose children, they still want to wash their clothes, tidy their bedroom, And there's also healthy rituals that you can do for yourself. You know, do a little bit of exercise, get out in the fresh air, you know, keep some healthy eating. But normally at the very beginning of it, everything goes to pot.
Yeah.
And you know, I always say to people, just do what you feel you can do. Just do enough for what you want to do for that day and keep it, you know, like I think it's with drinking, isn't it? Keep it in the day.
It's interesting because, you see, unless we've been through this, and of course everyone's experience is different anyway, we don't know what's normal, in inverted commas. So we don't know if it's okay to feel the way we're feeling and to, you know, to feel like we're losing the plot or to be washing the clothes or whatever, you know, all these little things. We don't know that that's normal if we're not connected, right? Yeah. This is where this I think is so interesting, because not enough people talk about these things. So we don't know if it's okay. And then we also hear of people who do rush absolutely straight back to normal life as if everything is fine, and then have a complete breakdown further down the line. I mean, is there such a thing as sort of that almost delayed reaction?
Absolutely. You know, what you just explained, if people, I mean, actually, I can't remember how long it is, and I think it's nothing more than 2 to 3 weeks if you have a loss or a bereavement in the family, then you have to be back to work. I mean, obviously now it's different. And, you know, that isn't time. That isn't long enough time.
What you mean most, do you mean most companies will give you compassionate leave for 2 or 3 weeks?
Yeah. And it isn't. And people you find will go back to work and then they break down at work, and then they're so worried about their job. So they're caught in this spiral of worry now because of their job, losing their job, feeling sad, not knowing how to cope with it. And really, it's really hard, isn't it, when you're working in a company and you want to be authentic and just be sad and break down. That's when you know, to the world, you put that mask on and you have to toughen up, which is more harmful than good, really, because what you're not doing is listening to your body. And your body speaks to you clearer than your mind. You know, it's about listening to your heart and going with that as much as possible.
So what would be your you know, how can someone who's going through grief then, whether it's early stages or, you know, a few months or even years on, how can they build their resilience, if you like, and strengthen some of those muscles?
It's really as simple as talking. You know, it's like we're having this conversation. It's talking, and talking to somebody that's not going to try and fix them, not make, depending on what the death is, you know, make sense of it. Just be there for them. Just really a listening ear is what people need more than anything in grief. Sometimes people need to be held. I mean, especially in the times we're living now, and people are losing people and they haven't even been able to hold their hands and be with them.
Yeah, that is heartbreaking.
I can't imagine how that must feel. And some people, you know, in the early days of COVID, people couldn't even go to funerals.
I know.
So that was just awful. So a suggestion sometimes is to create, I know you talked about rituals, but your own little ceremony. So maybe having I supported a group of women that lost their girlfriend, and, you know, it was just after we was coming out of the lockdown last year. And I said to bring something of her that, you know, that you remember her by. And we did a little circle, we lit candles, and there was a bottle of Prosecco there. And, you know, they did little memories, and it ended up a really lovely evening of the ladies laughing and reminiscing. Because a lot of them couldn't go to the funeral because it was only for, I think, about 6 at the time that was allowed to go. So you can do your own little rituals and your own little ceremonies to help you and support you.
Yeah.
And memory circles are the family's really good to do as well. You know, sit round as a family and, you know, bring something of, say it's your grandfather or, you know, your parent, bring something of theirs or a photo or a memory, just to get the family connected and really talking about it.
Yeah, it's really true, isn't it? And I think this piece about honouring that person's place within the family, even though they're no longer there, is really important. You know, whether that's a photo or a whatever. I know people who I don't know. I mean, is there a way that can be too much? Is it? I mean, how do we know? How do we know these things? I don't even know the question to ask.
Well,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's just personal. You know, because how can someone else tell us how we should hold a family member that we've lost, or how to grieve, or you know, I think that there are times when people really find it hard, like a few years down the line when they've kind of got a shrine where they won't let anything go. There's an unhealthy way, but you know, we're looking at years. But I don't think that there is a one answer fits all for that.
Yeah, but you know, this sort of old adage, oh, time heals. I mean, does it?
I think it gets less hurtful, less painful, and I don't really know. For some people it does, and again, I think it's the individual. It depends on your mindset, your emotional well-being, your spiritual connections. Some people can let go really easy and other people can't. So again, it's very individual.
Sounds
like maybe I'm not being that helpful, but
not at all. It is all what it is, isn't it?
Yeah,
but I just think even just talking about the problems and
it's a very intimate thing, grief.
Yeah.
Very intimate.
Yeah.
And I think it's for everybody to be able to hold it the way they want to hold it.
Yeah. You mentioned that some people, you know, that the way they deal with grief will depend on various things, and whether they perhaps have a faith or some kind of, you know, spirituality. And obviously the good thing now is that, you know, as opposed to some years ago, that there are now many more different ways, of course, of honouring honouring people in funerals. It's not as sort of straightforward as it used to be. There are many different ways you can do that, and I know we're going to talk about more. What do you think in terms of sort of spiritual teachings and wisdom? About death? What aspects of spiritual teachings and wisdom do you think are helpful for most people, if any?
So if people struggle with maybe a faith, or there is life after death, or wherever it is we go to after dying, I always suggest to people to read books about near-death experiences. I find them really helpful for people. And some people say, well, you know, people die, but they never come back and visit us. Well, actually, you know, the near-death experience people have got loads of amazing stories.
There's a great book by Anita Morjani, isn't there? You've read that one.
Yeah, I've read that one. And also a friend of mine, David Ditchfield, he's written an amazing book called Shine On. Be someone lovely for you to interview, because when he had his near-death experience, he came back an artist, he came back a musician, he came back with gifts he never had before.
Wow.
So, and he's a really down-to-earth man, and I love his book because I think a lot of people can relate to it.
So I suppose that takes away some of the fear when you hear from people. Anita Morjani speak about her near-death experience. The way she described it, it definitely takes away your fear.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if I'm really honest, I have a really strong faith. I have a deep spiritual practice. But sometimes I might lie there and think, oh, you know, is there really? Because again, the mind wants evidence. And so if I've been in a place where I've felt a bit doubtful, I go back to these kind of near-death experiences, or, you know, I'll get into my meditation. But I think, you know, being human, you're going to get little shadows of doubt at times. I think that's natural too.
Absolutely. So let's just talk a bit about, those of us who are blessed to be alive, but we are going to die. All right. And as you say, none of us know when. So, you know, I think it is really important for us to address our own end of life journey, as you say. This is a slight aside, but I'm sure you've read Bronnie Ware's book, you know, the Top 5 Regrets of the Dying.
No, I haven't.
Oh, have you not? Oh, man. Oh, you have to read that. It's a fantastic book. Bronnie Ware is her name. She's a Hay House author. I interviewed her for Hay House Radio. Fascinating book, because she was a palliative care nurse for a long time. Mm-hmm. And she obviously worked with loads and loads of people who were dying. And over the years, she started to keep notes of some of the conversations she had. Yeah. And she basically, over time, realised that just about everyone she spoke to had some regrets. She would talk to them about their regrets. And then she kind of boiled it down to these top five or top 10 regrets of the dying. And it's all the stuff that you would imagine. It's, you know, I wish I'd connected.
Spent more time with people.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly that. You'd imagine. Yeah, I can't remember them all, but they're obvious.
No one says, I wanted to earn more money at the end of the day.
Exactly, exactly. No one says, oh, I so wish I'd drunk more wine or spent more time at the office, or, you know, it's all the stuff you would fully expect. So it's about living life to the full, of course. But as well as living life to the full, what can we do then towards planning our own, you know, as you say, our own end of life journey? How can we do that in such a way that, it doesn't freak us out? Because it does make us feel freaked out.
I know, but I think if you can keep your family and your loved ones in mind when you're doing it. I mean, for me, when I did mine, I just got a big scrapbook. I picked out photos and poems and bits of memorabilia. I've got memory boxes for my two daughters.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing idea.
And now we've got technology. So make little videos, you know, make it fun and intimate. Just little bits of, so I've put little bits of things that I even got my two original teddy bears from when I was a baby. So I've put one of them each in each of their boxes. They probably won't appreciate them, but it's just making something really personal.
So you're saying it could be like a box or just a book but it's something that you will physically pass on, or rather you won't, but will be passed on.
So it's just the memory box or the memory book, so that they've got something that's really lovely that they can, you know, look back at and you know, have some nice memories. But also another thing is to make sure that you prepare your funeral.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, what is it that you'd want? I mean, there's different options out there. For me personally, I'd want a natural woodland burial funeral. We did this young girl again. We did an amazing funeral where it was an absolutely natural woodland burial. So that means no metal, nothing that's going to contaminate the ground. And there was all bales of hay around her coffin when she went down with flowers laid. And then there was a little tent at the side with hot soups and rolls. Wow. And the family and friends just sat there. And this is another thing that, you know, I really want to put across is when you're planning your funeral, pick somebody that's going to give you time, because there's nothing worse than when you're really sad and you're grieving, and the traditional funerals just seem to make it more harrowing, you know, in my experience. And they're a conveyor belt, you know, especially the crematoriums. There's so much people don't know. If you run over time, you get charged more.
Well, also, it's, you know, hugely embarrassing when you turn up and you're worried you're going to get in the queue for the wrong funeral.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they pack them in.
I know. It's, and also, you know, like, people want to do funeral plans. I would say to people, because we've had a couple of people recently that have had funeral plans, and because of COVID, these are just things to flag up. They've not been able to change their minds. So if somebody had booked a crematorium and then changed their mind for a woodland burial site, so they wouldn't change it within the plan, so they lost their money. Wow. With the COVID as well, there are some funeral people that are saying, no, you can't go and visit your loved ones. So they're left in cold storage without any of their clothes to go on them or anything. So that's really harrowing for people. And other funeral directors are saying, oh no, we have to embalm if you want to come and visit in the Chapel of Rest, which is, for me, really off, because they normally charge another £8,000 to £1,000 for that, which is again unnecessary. There's no evidence at the moment, and on their own admission, they're just doing it precautionary. Now, if someone's been dead for a few days, there's nothing coming out of them. Mm-hmm. So really that there's no contamination. Mm. And so what we do at DIY funerals is, you know, we'll go and it's another thing people can do at home that they don't realise that they can do.
What does it mean? What does DIY funerals mean? I don't know what the term means. Explain it to me.
Create your own funeral. So rather than spending all out on a funeral director, we would just guide you and help you. Because people don't know that they can do their own funerals.
No, well, absolutely.
They don't know that they can take their own funeral.
No, they
you
don't.
Know, you don't need a celebrant or a priest.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, how I got into it was a couple of years ago, I went to look after a lady who had ovarian cancer, and I kind of fell into it by accident, and I was doing some therapies on her and doing juice and nutrition with her. And anyway, they asked me to stay, and I ended up staying there for 6 weeks, and she died. And then I dressed her body, and it would just come naturally just to lay her in a lovely sheet, put petals over, play some nice music in the room. So there's that whole care of the body, and people don't realise that you can stay at home. You can keep your loved one at home. There's special equipment that we can give you to keep your body, your loved one cold and cool. I mean, some people have kept their partner and slept with them in bed. I mean, I don't think I could go as far as that, but, you know, some people have found it really comforting and have found the grieving process a lot easier because of they've actually taken care of them. Mm. And we used to do this years ago.
Yes,
but all
of
a sudden now, the funeral directors take over, and everybody's, you know, just don't know that they've got all these rights.
Wow!
If you die in hospital, you can have the body brought home. Nobody owns your body.
And just one last question then. For anyone who is, you know, suffering from grief right now and recognises that this is grief, whether it's from someone who's died really quite recently or even quite a while ago, and they're basically drinking to numb out, what would you say to that person?
Just talk to somebody and be open and honest, and go to somebody that you know that's not going to judge you, that's going to love you and hold you and help you and support you. Not in a way of criticising you, but just in a way that's... And if there's no one out there like that, give me a call.
Thank you, Sharon. Definitely lots to think about there, without any shadow of a doubt. Really appreciate it. Our Sober Club members did an exclusive Q&A with Sharon as well, and some found it, you know, really, really super helpful to be able to deal with some stuff that I haven't dealt with in years. I think that's kind of it for this week. I feel like I've been chatting to you for ages. Make sure you check out thesoberclub.com, of course, for connection and inspiration and accountability. Always reach out if you need help. There's always help available. And of course, I would love it if you'd buy the book, Happy, Healthy, Sober, Ditch the Booze and Take Control of Your Life. In case you haven't heard me mention it before, It's got a whole section on how to ditch the booze and how to make it easier for yourself in the early weeks. But it's also got a massive section on all kinds of lifestyle stuff, everything from creativity through nutrition, through mindset, NLP, therapies. There's even a bit on natural skincare. There's just about everything in there. So it really doesn't matter whether you are at the beginning of your sober journey, sober curious, or whether you've been sober for years. It's ultimately a health and well-being book, really. So anyways, if you want a signed copy, if you click on shop in the Sober Club, we can organise a signed copy if you're in the UK, or you can grab it on Amazon. And obviously, I'd love it if you'd give me a review. That would just be amazing. I would really appreciate that. We've got some great guests coming up in the next few weeks, a real mix of topics. I'm not going to share them all with you yet because they're not all firmed up, but we've got some great guests. And if you ever have a suggestion for me of a guest you'd like me to try and get on the show, then I'll absolutely give it a go. Without any shadow of a doubt, I love getting your feedback. If if you'd like to share this episode or let anyone know about it, then we'd be absolutely delighted. You know where to find me on social media, at Janie Lee Grace, and all the competitions and all the blog posts and stuff are at thesoberclub.com. See you soon. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.